1 Corinthians chapter 3. And we're going to start at verse 5. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 5. Paul says, "What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one, and each will receive his wages according to his labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care of how he builds upon it, for no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has laid on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Lord, we ask that you would remind us of what it is to be active investors out of our affection for you. It's in the name of your Son, Christ, we pray. Amen. We are in the middle of a series entitled, It's Time to Grow Up, and we are walking our way through the book of 1 Corinthians. And one of the things that has been driven home by Paul since the very first verse of the very first chapter of this book is that there were divisions in the church. And because there were divisions in the church, they had a display. He had evidence of their immaturity. And he's saying, because you have decided to identify yourself according to one leader versus another, I know that you are children in the faith, because only children would do such a thing. You have decided that you want to have some facet of the Christian faith, and you want to change, you want to adjust, you want to mix it with something else of your preference. And because of that, we know that you want the benefits of being a child, while at the same time wanting the benefits of adulthood. You want the autonomy of adulthood, but you want to be cared for. You want to be nurtured and taken care of in the manner that a child would be. He's saying, because of that, I have evidence. I know that you are immature. He walks them through the foolishness of that division. He shows them how he, Apollos, and Cephas are of the same servant office. They're merely servants of the Most High God. We're not the ones you should follow. You should follow the one to whom we point. He says to them in chapter 2, you would get a glimpse of this if you were to experience maturity. And by maturity, he means submission to the Spirit of God. He says, I know that some of you are mature. And then he goes into detail explaining what maturity is. Maturity is the capacity, the ability to see things and appreciate things that are on high. And worldliness, immaturity, is limiting yourself to that which is down low. In fact, believing that that which is low is all there is. He's saying those who submit themselves to the Spirit of God are able to appreciate the high things. And because they can appreciate the high things, this is chapter 2, they're able to appreciate these things that is evidence of their maturity. So they don't restrict themselves to their childish preferences and their immature limitations and adolescent desires, because they know that this is not all there is. They're able to look beyond what is in front of them and get a glimpse of that which is on high, because they know that that is what they're actually living for. Are you with me? That was chapter 2. I want you to understand this. Chapters 1 through 3 is his introduction to the letter. He has spent quite a bit of time unfolding this particular issue. And what he does is repeatedly point back to it and then draw tangential illustrations and lessons from it so that they can be set up for the practical discussions he's going to start having with them in chapter 4. He's not done with the introduction of this issue yet. So he brings up the Paul and Apollos division in the church again.
He's saying that some of you are saying I'm followers of him, and some of you are saying I'm followers of him, and all you're doing is you're taking two men who are on equal footing, and you're deciding that the one who meets your preference most is the one that you're going to follow. He's saying the foolishness of that is, and I covered this last week, the foolishness of that is we are the same person. We hold the same office. You're so focused on the two people who are coming in second place that you miss the winner who's out front. He says, don't look to us. Look to the one to whom we are pointing. We're not here to glorify us. We're here to bring attention to the God who has called us. And he unfolds that in detail, starting at the beginning of chapter 3. Then he brings up a point, saying, I love the way he does this, because he takes advantage of opportunities. Because he's having to teach them this lesson, he decides to pause and teach them a supplementary lesson. He's saying, since you're in this place, and I'm having to address this issue anyway, he says, since I'm here, let me give you another thing that you need to appreciate for your own lives. He's about to tell them that you, even though you presently have an eternal relationship with the God of whom we speak, you presently have it. You're not working toward it, and we're going to cover that in a moment. You already have it. You are still to stop and assess your life and ask yourself, does the life that I live reflect the office that I have? Does the life that I live reflect the office that I have? Am I living as though I have been made righteous and been placed on high by the God who sits on high? Can people look at me and tell? I have a professor named Dr. Payne, and he and I are having a conversation about this because he's presently just messing up my view of sanctification. He's absolutely messing it up. I'm coming into his class intending to present an argument for progressive sanctification. It's a thing that you are entering into from the moment you are transformed. You experience this justification, and then you start this process. I've been justified. This is what I've been teaching my entire adult life. I have been justified, and because I have been justified, I now take the grace of that justification, and I enter into a progress known as sanctification. That's what I have been teaching from the moment I started preaching. That's all I've ever known. And I started an independent study with Dr. Payne, and I intended to write a paper defending progressive sanctification. And the very first day we sat down one-on-one in his office, he completely ruined it by telling me there is no such thing as progressive sanctification. No such thing. He says, you receive the office of saint. You are fully sanctified the moment you have him. You experience justification and the fullness of sanctification at the same time. Now, those of you who know me know that if I have believed something for 13 years and I sit down with a man who in 13 seconds tells me I have been wrong for the past decade and a half, I'm going to have questions for him. So he and I enter into a conversation where I'm pushing back and I'm telling him, no, but look, he says, Paul says here that we are to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. And he says, yes, but where is hagios in the passage? He doesn't mention sanctification. Okay, what about Romans chapter 12 when he says that you are to experience the transformation by the renewal of your mind? He says that's a process. You go through this process. He says, yes, but notice he calls it transformation. He does not call it sanctification. He says the whole point of living the victorious Christian life is not so that you can become sanctified. It's so that you may live as though you are sanctified. God graciously gave you the office of saint before you did anything. You do not work towards sanctification. You work out of sanctification. You don't work so that you can move toward it. You work because you have it. It is your intention to not pursue this goal so that God will be pleased, so that he can experience joy. You move toward this goal because he's the goal, and you're moving closer to him because he is your greatest joy. That's his emphasis. Ruined it. Changed my paper. Ruined it. I paid him. to ruin that for me. Then he sits me down, and he knows that we're doing a series through 1 Corinthians. So he has me turn to 1 Corinthians, and he says, look at the audience to whom he writes the letter. He says in chapter 1, verse 1, Paul, called to be by the will of God, to be an apostle of Christ Jesus, and our brothers and sisters, and our brother Sosthenes, to the church of God that is in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus. Notice the word is past tense. They're not trying to get toward it. They already have it. Paul's frustration with them in this church was not that they were not moving toward sanctification. He's saying that you are not currently behaving as someone who has received sanctification. They are already saints. And his response, his call to them is to live as though that is true. One of my biggest passions is marriage. It's a thing for me because we tend to not get that right. We mess it up quite a bit, especially guys. Mess us up quite a bit. I'm hearing some ums. So I got witnesses. Okay, so especially guys, because we believe that the person I am after I get married and the person I am before I get married have identical responsibilities, and I don't have to make any adjustment from the pre-married man to the post-married man. She has to merely adjust to who I am. That's what marriage is, right? When we got married, we did our vows and we did that whole honor and love and obey. And so I'm this person before I get married, and here she shows up and she's telling me that she wants to join the show. And since I'm the center of the show, then she has to adjust to the person that I am. So I will continue to live as the pre-married man, even though I am now in a post-married state. And when I sit down with that guy, after smacking him around a little bit, we have a conversation where I have to explain to him that there was a moment at the altar where a pastor of some name, if I was there, I know I said this. There was a moment when I said, it was my privilege to introduce to you Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. I prefaced that statement by declaring you husband and wife. When I made that statement, I executed what is known as performative speech. What I said did something. Before I said it, you were not married. After I said it, you were. Whether you felt like it or not, you were. The statement I made did not simply reference something. It was not describing something. It created something. Before, you were single. And I made a declaration at the altar. And after I made the declaration, you are no longer single. When you move from the office of single man to the office of married man, there were certain responsibilities and changes that should have come along with the transition. When you brought the single man into the married relationship, you are now living a lie in which you are not reflecting the office that you hold. At the moment of your conversion, God, he gave you performative speech. I now pronounce you sanctified. You may not feel like it, but in spite of that, the statement that he made brought into existence something that was not there before. You went from being separated from God to being identified with God. And he's saying to you that you are supposed to make the transition from the dead person to the person who is now alive and holds the office of saint. Your responsibility is not to move toward this being a reality. I have made this a reality. So you live as though you are in the reality. When I sit down with a married man who's living as though he's single, I do not give him 15 principles and means by which he can understand what it is to be a married man. You know what I do? I remind him that he is married. That's all I have to do. Well, that's not all I have to do. I have to remind him and then say it loudly and be annoyed and emphatic and remind him again. But I'm not introducing him to anything new. I'm reminding him of that which he already knew. You are married, and married men Don't do this. That's the emphasis of it. The entirety, I'm scared to tell you this because you may not come back. The entirety of 1 Corinthians is, you are saints, and saints don't do this. That's the whole book. That is the big statement, the big idea of the entire book. As saints, you don't do this. In fact, when we get to chapter 6, he's going to give a list of sins, and he's going to say to people who are currently living out those sins, he's going to say to them, and such were some of you. He says that there's marital infidelity, and there's premarital sex, and there's homosexuality, and there's slander, and there's disrespect toward parents. He says, you used to be those things. He's saying that to people who are presently living out those things. He's saying, you hold an office that does not live this way. Your responsibility is to experience transformation so that the office that you hold can be evident to people who see you. Now, how does he unfold that for us? Look back at chapter 3, and we're going to start at verse 10. He says, according to the grace of God, how does he illustrate this for us? According to the grace of God, given to me like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Now, he's changed his illustration. Remember, before, it was an agrarian illustration. He says, I planted, someone else watered, and God reaped the increase. He's gone from the planting of a harvest in a field to the building of a facility. They're no longer, the church is no longer a garden now, starting in verse 10. They're now a building that's being erected. He's saying that I laid the foundation, like a skilled builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it, for no one can be a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. So here's what he's saying. I came in and I laid a foundation. I'm the foundation layer. I came in and laid a strong foundation, and that foundation is Christ. He says, what you all have done is you've looked at Apollos and Cephas, who came after me and started erecting bricks on top of the foundation that I laid, and you're saying because they are the present bricklayers, their responsibility, their role is more important than mine. Or you're saying, because Paul laid the foundation, which is most important among all the things to be done here, you're saying that what I did is more important than what they did. And what they all need to understand is, while I laid the foundation, and Cephas and Apollos are putting the bricks on top of it, God is the general contractor who brought all of us into the conversation. He's the one that equipped us to do the very thing that you're worshiping us for. Instead of looking at us, you should look to him, because that's the one to whom we look. He says that clearly. He says because we're not looking to you to get accolades. We're looking to the one who called us, the general contractor, because he's the one whose accolades are eternal. How does he say that? Look at what he says in verse 11. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Here's what he just told you. He's saying, this is the image. There are multiple forms of work that we extend to God. He categorizes them into two categories, but he gives you a list of six examples. And one of the first list is three things that are precious: gold, silver, and precious stones. And the next one is wood, hay, and stubble. He says these are all works that we extend to God. And the day is a reference to the moment when God comes and he judges, not judging to determine who is going to enter the kingdom and who is not. He's not judging who is believer and who isn't. He's judging the life lived of, and he's doing it with every single person who is going to enter the kingdom. Believers experience an assessment day as well. What is he assessing? What work have we done for him? Is it gold, silver, and precious stones? Or is it wood, hay, and stubble? He gives this image of a test where fire will come through and assess the things you have offered to him. And if it is gold, silver, and precious stone, it will only be honed and refined by the fire. If it is wood, hay, and stubble, it will burn up. He says those who are the believers in him who receive the, who make it through to the other side of this fire, when these things that they've offered to God, when they pass through that fire, they will experience reward. We'll cover that in a moment. He says those who experience the removal, the destruction of their work, they will experience nothingness and they will still be in his presence, but yet only as through fire. He says you'll make it through, but you'll come through empty-handed because everything that you did not reflect that you were a saint. It only reflected that you desire to know him in name, but not in action. Everyone in the room is thinking, he's not talking to me. That's for someone else. In fact, here's the problem with illustrations. Everyone, I know this happens quite a bit. Everyone will do one of two things, depending on what point we're in and what's being said. You will either assume I'm not talking about you, or you will assume I'm talking about no one except you, okay? It's either he's not talking to or about me, or he's putting my business out in the street. That's what I get from you. That's what I get. So here's how that looks, okay? So if we're talking about something that is sinful, okay, yeah, he's talking to somebody else. I don't have this issue. I'm fine here. I don't have this problem. If we're talking about something that is sin, but you don't agree with it being sin, and we address it, and I say something in an illustration, even though you, among 40 other people in the room, are in that same season, you will think, he's talking about me. Listen to me. I'm not talking about you. I'm not missing you either, but I'm not talking about you. Don't sit there and say, okay, I'm going to craft this very well-designed email because he almost said my name during the sermon in a specific illustration. That's not what I'm doing here. That is not what I'm doing. Look at me. That is not what I'm doing. It's not just you. It's not just you. Now, here's what wood, hay, stubble looks like. There are certain things that God has told us we should not do, and things that God has called us to do. But because we do not approve of what God has called us to, we will refine it. We'll adjust it. And we'll do something that is like it, but it has to meet with our standards of joy. And because we will adjust it to meet with our standards of joy, we will take what he's called us to and say, God, that's not exactly what I want to do, and we'll adjust it. And then after we've adjusted it, then we will offer that back to him and expect him to smile. Wood, hay, stubble. You think you're doing a great job. I give him all this stuff. I have all this stuff for him, but it's not the stuff he wants. You're giving stuff to him, and because you're giving it to him, you have checked these things off your list. I made my offering for the day. I've made this gift. I've given him this thing. Here you go, God. Now, take it and be happy about it. And that's not how it works. He does not want your revision of his plan. He does not want your revision of his offering. He wants the offering that he has placed into your hand. And if you adjust it, all you have done is taint it. And in tainting it, you have made it worthless. It is wood, hay, and stubble that will be destroyed on the day. When I was you've heard this before. When I was a sophomore in college, my roommate and I moved out of the dorm because you had to turn the music off in the dorm. During the week, you had the music off by 10. And on the weekends, you had to have it off by midnight. We had two, this is the craftiness of 19-year-old men. We had two stereos in our dorm room, and we would synchronize them with the same CD. Yes, I'm telling myself, it was the Chronic. And we would synchronize, we would say, ready, set, play. And because of that, the same songs would be twice as loud because we're playing them from two separate stereos. And by the way, it would take us a while to get this right because we'd be off by a half second or a quarter of a second. We'd be there for 30 minutes so that we can make sure that the CD plays straight through, uninterrupted and unbroken. We did that. We would set it up so that the two stereos were playing the same CD, and we would open the door, and everyone on the hall would be out in the hall, and it'd be kind of like this party in the hall. And it was just a jam. We were just doing this stuff. And I lived in a co-ed dorm, and all the even floors were male, and the odd floors were women. And so the women would come up to our floor and be like this. We had this like this little house party. It was a rave in the dorm room, in the hallway. And our dorm director, our RA, would be at the end of the hall because that's where his room was. His name was Nick. I went to high school with Nick. And he ended up being my RA in college. And he's standing there at the end of the hall looking at me like, 5, 4, 3. Shut it down. Every single time, every time. I know you're thinking, when did you study? Study. Okay, listen. We were out in the hall and we were getting our party on, but because Nick would ruin it every night, 10 o'clock at midnight, we had to party past midnight. We need to party past midnight. Because if we don't party past midnight, then life is ruined. Go to bed. What are you talking about? We have to party. So what do? We get our own apartment. And we moved into this apartment, and the problem with it was, while we did have the freedom to party past midnight, we were broke. And because we were broke, all we had was party. But we didn't have anything to eat. We didn't have anything of sustenance, nothing like that. So my father would go to Sam's Club, and he would buy these big packages of ramen noodles, and we would survive on ramen noodles. I could make Thanksgiving dinner with some ramen, like this is turkey ramen. We came up with all kinds of slice up the onions. And, okay, anyway, that's how we survived it. That's how we did it. The problem with that was, but he pulled up on that because we were approaching Christmas. And he's like, you're coming home for Christmas. So make it until you get home. We look in the refrigerator. Now you understand, okay? Devin was 6'6", about 260. All right, we're not too... I mean, when it's time to eat, we want to eat something. We opened the refrigerator. We had a half gallon of milk and a half carton of eggs. I'm not making this up. Devin, business major, brilliant man. He's an investment banker today, probably rich. He says to me, this is what we'll do. Let's go to the store and buy one of those half cartons of eggs. And we'll mix it with these eggs, and we'll make a big omelet that we'll split in half. Here's the problem with that plan. The eggs that were in the refrigerator, I don't even know when we bought them. They had been there for 6, 7, 8 weeks. Because, you know, you clean up by eating it. Okay, and so they had been there forever. My point to you is they were rotten and not edible. His thought was, if we mix the bad eggs with the good eggs, then the goodness of the good eggs will overtake the badness of the bad eggs, and we will have one delicious omelet. And it'll look good. It'll be ornamented because we'll have some red bell peppers in there and it'll look beautiful on the plate. But the fact, the whole time is, I'm thinking while we're eating this, I'm going to catch something. We're going to get sick. I might die eating this food. Because in spite of his thought, where he thought the goodness would overtake the bad, that's entirely backwards. What actually happens is the rottenness of the bad eggs contaminates what is good. Listen, the rottenness of the bad eggs contaminates that which is good. And because of that, you cannot identify any of it as acceptable. On a regular basis, we come to God and we say, God, okay, I hear this good thing. I'm going to take this and I'm going to half do it. But it's not exactly as I want it to be because I have some preferences here that are not being met. I'm going to take my preference and I'm going to mix them with your preferences. And I'm okay with that because the goodness of your preferences will overtake the badness, if there are any, of my preferences, and we, God, will sit down and we will have a delicious omelet. And God is saying to you, when you added your works to my goodness, you did not make your works good. You contaminated your offering to me. Wood, hay, stubble. Because we present this sickening, repulsive omelet and say, hey, God, eat this. And he's saying, I will not. In spite of what you think, you have not given me offering. You've given me filth. So what does the ongoing offering look like? He says explicitly in verse 13, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If it survives, he will receive a reward. Now, we can have a debate about what the reward is. We can have a debate about if it's tangible, if it's visible, if it's experiential. We can have a debate about this, but the one thing we cannot debate is that it exists. Okay? In eternity, we know that among believers, there will be some display of people who served him in a submissive manner, and there will be some display of people who served him in a selfish manner. I have this office of saint, and I have taken it readily, and I've added my works to it. We will know what that looks like. And there will be others who say, I give my all to him, and I will only live the life he has called me to, and it will be evident who was who. Now, let me say this, because I don't want you to send me any emails. There will be no one in heaven walking around with their arms folded like, I don't even want to be here. His house is bigger than mine. I don't even like that. Look at Billy Graham up there on that hill. Man, that ain't even right. That's not what I'm saying. No one's going to be walking around like that. But here's the thing that you understand. On the day of glorification, I can't go into too much detail because we'll be here all day. On the day you're glorified, you will have a heightened sense of justice. So when you see people experiencing and enjoying the rewards of having served him well, that will not create division among us. You will rejoice for them over the life that they lived in time. What I'm telling you is, look, live a life to which people will look and rejoice for you in eternity. Do you hear me? He says, instead of giving him wood, hay, and stubble, give him that which is precious. Now, here's my concern. I don't want you to leave here thinking, Brandon said that it is our duty to live hard for God. I don't want you to hear me saying that. I would rather you hear me say that it is your joy. If God is your exceeding joy, then you should relish in making him happy by giving him the valuable offering. Do you hear me? So I've been married for 10 years now. It's really a bad day for me to use this illustration because I've been slacking in this area. But it's the best one I have, okay? Been married for 10 years. And my rookie year, I learned a lot about, not just married, but marriage to this woman, okay? Learned a lot about what it's to be married to her. One of the things about my wife is she doesn't like roses. She's not a roses person, not a fan of the roses. She loves tulips. I did not learn until my fourth year that I have been buying the wrong colored tulips. But I got that right. We're fixed, okay? So my point to you is, though, she's not a roses person. She's a tulips person, okay? That works out for me because a dozen roses cost significantly more than two bunches of tulips. By the way, did you catch that? Roses come in dozens. Tulips come in bunches because I'm not a rookie anymore, okay? So on the way home, I can stop by Whole Foods because Whole Foods sells bunches of tulips, and you can buy a bunch of 10 for roughly $9 or $10, significantly less than a dozen roses. What if I stopped at Whole Foods and purchased for my wife two bunches of tulips? And I go to the front door, and I do something I never do, and that is I ring the doorbell instead of using my key to enter the house. And she opens the door, and she sees these tulips in my hand. And she says, Brandon, this is beautiful. Why did you do this for me? And my response was, because it's my duty. It's my job. The Cowboys are playing the Redskins on Monday Night Football. And I know that if I don't show up with some tulips, I actually do know this. I know that if I don't show up with some tulips, I'm going to have to hear about it. So to keep you quiet, to make you happy so you will leave me alone and I can watch the game, here are your tulips. Are you happy now? I will sleep in the car, okay? That would not go well, okay? Just so you know. Yes, I see some young men in the room wondering, listen to me, don't do that, okay? Don't do that. Same scenario. Pick up the tulips, I'm on my way home. Ring the doorbell. She comes to the door. Brandon, why did you do this? And my response is, because it brings me joy to bring you joy. Because you are, among all human beings, the one I love most. And I love to see a smile on your face. I desire to have that joyful, exuberant feeling within me. And I can only experience it when I see you experiencing joy out of something I have done. I don't do this because I must do it. I do it because I get to enjoy the pleasure of doing this for you. If I give you this, does all the other stuff come? Yes. Do I get to watch the Cowboys and the Redskins uninterrupted? You bet. Yes, there are fringe benefits to this, but that cannot be the thing that motivates it. The thing that motivates it is when I look at her and see her smile and I have an involuntary response in which I smile, that is why she wants me to buy the tulips. She does not want me to do it out of duty. She wants me to do it out of joy. The God who we serve is saying, give me that which is precious. And he's saying, I don't want you to do it because you have to do it. I don't want you to do it because if you don't, then you'll walk around heaven embarrassed because you'll lack a reward. I don't want you to look at this because you're thinking there's a day, capital D in your Bibles to say it should be a capital D day. I'm looking at that day in which the fire is going to come and consume the wood, hay, and the stubble. I don't want to have that happen before me, so I got to make sure I do this so I can have some stuff that day. No, I want you to recognize that he's saying, give me that which is precious because I am precious. And because I'm worthy of all that is precious, then that is what you bring to me. And it should not be because you have to. It should be because you relish in the very joy of doing it with me. He has gifted every single person in this room who knows his son by name. If you're in this room and you have identified Christ as your Savior, he has done two things, at least two things for you. He has indwelled you with his Spirit, so you have a little piece of heaven a long way from home. And that Spirit has gifted you with the ability to put God on display. He does not want for you to sit back and say, thank you for these gifts. I will use some of it for you, and I will use the rest of it to point toward myself. He would rather you say, I have no idea why you saw fit to do this with me. And I'm going to make this offering to you, not because I have to, but because I get to. If he is first and foremost, if he is your exceeding joy, if he is the most supreme person in all of your life, then you should sit back and say, I don't want to give him that which is left over. I want to give him that which is valuable. That wasn't even a big point of the passage. He's telling them, we are here to build up to him. And while we're building a facility up to him, I laid a foundation, Apollos came in and stacked the bricks. You're looking at us and you're seeing our offerings to him and you're worshiping our offerings to him instead of recognizing that we're giving that which is precious to the one who is precious. So here's your self-assessment. Because you're going to fall in multiple categories in this room. Either you do not know him, and this whole dialogue was wasted because we skipped something, and that is you are sanctified because of identifying Christ as your Redeemer. You hold the office of saint because you have been elevated and seated in heavenly places because Christ died for the remission of your sin. Or you are in this room and you have him, and you are in the office of saint, and you step back and say, what have I been giving to him? What have I been giving him? What are the tangible, practical things you need to be wondering about? Here's the question you ask yourself. Have I been giving him my singleness? Or have I been mixing it with my preferences so it's partially pleasing him and partially pleasing me? Have I been giving him my marriage? Is it partially pleasing me and partially pleasing him? I'm trying to make everybody happy, me and him, but I want to be happy on my terms. So I want to give him this partial commitment, this partial offering. And in giving him this partial offering, you're giving him wood, hay, and stubble. Is your job yours? Or is it his? And you're splitting it between you and him. Is your money yours? I'm gonna tip God. Tip God. Pause for a moment. Tip God. We show up, and God is responsible for every single thing you have in your pocket. Everything. And he says to you, go ahead and budget some of it and then move the mission of my making me famous along. And you say, let me see what I have on me. And you tip the one who's responsible for every single cent you have. You're saving some of it for you and glorifying you with it, and you're depriving him of that glory when you're doing it. But you expect him to be happy by what you've offered to him. No, he wants that which is precious. Why? Because he's supreme in all things, and therefore he is worthy of all that is precious. And because he's supreme in all things, you sit back and say, my singleness is not mine, it is his. I will live it for him. My sexuality is not mine. I will offer it to him in the manner in which he requests it. I will honor him with my marriage or my singleness and my sexuality and my finances and my job, because this is what makes him happy. And when he is happy, I rejoice. Psalm 37, we're done. Psalm 37 says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. I've heard a man whose name I'm not going to say. He's in Texas, large church. Come over, okay? I've heard him use that passage to say, if you love God, he will make you rich. You know what the passage actually means? If you love God, you will only want what he wants. And if you want what he wants, then he gives it to you. He gives you the desires of your heart because your heart desires what his heart desires. St. Augustine said, love God and everything else will take care of itself. If he's first and foremost in your affections, then you only want that which brings him joy. And because you only want that which brings him joy, then he gives you that which brings you joy. Is he first and foremost in your affections? Are we building up a facility of wood, hay, and stubble? And when the gaze, the assessing, the judging eyes of the master look upon it, will it be destroyed and we'll be standing there with nothing? Or will we have a precious building built for his sake?